The Treasury Department's implementation of the TARP program has been a bureaucratic fiasco.
Hi, and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. I'm David Kestenbaum in Washington, D.C.
And in New York, I'm Laura Conaway. It's Friday, January 16th. On today's show, the way deep innards of LIBOR.
Plus, we're going to look for some corner of the globe that hasn't been totally crushed by the recession.
Because we're going there. But first, at the top of the show, we heard Republican Senator Richard Shelby.
Richard Shelby's not happy about the bailout and how it's been run. A lot of that money has been used to help banks that are in trouble, which actually brings us to today's Planet Money indicator, $20 billion. And this just happened this morning. The Treasury Department is going to invest another $20 billion in Bank of America.
So, folks, this whole thing with the banks being in trouble, it is not over yet. Part of the problem here today is that Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch owned a lot of these mortgage-backed securities that have been giving banks fits. The deal apparently was hammered out at midnight last night.
And there's another part to the deal, which is potentially a bigger part. The government is going to basically sell Bank of America insurance in case things go bad with those mortgage-backed securities. So there's a pool of $118 billion worth of securities, including mortgage-backed securities. And if something goes wrong with those, Bank of America is going to have to eat the first $10 billion in losses. But after that, the government is going to take most of the hit.
Now, the government does get a fee for the insurance, and there are some strings attached. The government gets to approve executive bonuses and also dividends that are paid to stockholders. And get this, those dividends cannot be more than one penny per share.
We did have some good news this week, though. The TED spread, an economic indicator, really, you know, the economic indicator we've been following here since the very beginning of the crisis, it dropped below 1.0.
Now, the TED spread shows us how the credit markets are doing. For a long time, as we've been telling you here on Planet Money, those credit markets have been frozen, and they seem now to gradually be thawing.
And I promised when the TED spread got below one, we were going to have a party. Just
nice.
Yeah, I think that's Henry Paulson in the big sneakers on stage doing the baby freeze.
Hey, you know, I set aside a bottle of wine here for just this occasion.
Oh, great. What year is it?
It's from September.
Yeah, the TED spread is basically back to where it was in September before all hell broke loose. It shot way up over four, and it's kind of come down from the mountain. We're kind of back in the rocky foothills now.
We wanted to invite TED to his own TED spread party, except there is no TED.
No, it's just an acronym. But there is this guy.
My name is John Ewan. I am a director at the British Bankers Association. My responsibility is to ensure that LIBOR is calculated accurately and on time.
John is as close as you get to a celebrity here. He's TED, basically. LIBOR, which he mentioned, is really the critical number that goes into the TED spread. It is the London Interbank Offered Rate. It's the interest rate that banks charge when they lend to each other. So a high number means they're not so psyched about lending. They're demanding a high interest rate. A low number means credit is flowing.
You know, these numbers can seem really boring, like this sort of endless parade of digits. But they're really never just numbers. For unemployment, for instance, people at the Labor Department pick up the phone and call folks all over the country and they say, are you working?
And for inflation, they actually go out and survey the price of eggs. I was looking this up, milk and beer and T-shirts and CDs and thousands of things. John Ewan says LIBOR is pretty simple. It's just the average of interest rates from 16 banks.
These are banks that you'll recognize, Bank of America, the Citigroup, there's JP Morgan. There's also from the European side, there's Deutsche Bank. There's Royal Bank of Scotland, HSBC, there's Bank of Tokyo, Mitsubishi, and a few others.
And so basically you ask them, you say, okay, when you borrow money from each other and lend to each other, what's the interest rate you're charging right now?
That's absolutely right.
And how often do you ask them that, or how often do they give you the information?
We calculate a rate every London business day. The rate is as at 11 o'clock in London, so that's the time at which we ask the banks to send in their data.
How many decimal places is it?
We always quote to five.
Five decimal places?
Yeah, they are really careful about how they calculate this number because LIBOR is used everywhere. It's really at the heart of lending. Some mortgages are pegged to LIBOR, some college loans. There are billions of dollars worth of derivatives traded on the options exchange in Chicago related to LIBOR. So they're very, very careful with it. And the interest rates that go into it are communicated on these dedicated computer lines. John Ewan says the calculation is actually done by a company that specializes in business statistics called Thomson Reuters.
And Thomson Reuters then run a whole barrage of different checks on the rates, and those are both automated and also manual by their team of analysts. And then they press a button and the calculation is done and the rates are released to the markets at the same time.
It seems like it wouldn't be that complicated. It's really just an averaging of a handful of numbers, right?
Oh, the actual calculation itself is, yeah, you or I could do it on the back of an envelope. That's not difficult. But the key to it is that it's got to be right first time. Because we really don't want to be in a situation where we say, guys, I'm really sorry, we forgot to carry the seven. Can we just restate the rate?
Right. And that's all his responsibility. So LIBOR has been dropping, and the TED spread, I'll just define it here. It is the difference between LIBOR and the interest rate the U.S. government pays to borrow money. That serves as a kind of floor. The TED spread has been dropping to now what are more historically normal-ish rates. We're still a lot above what it was in 2006 and 2007. But John Ewan says this is all pretty good news.
Certainly, all of the credit markets are looking a lot healthier. And I think this is partially because banks are trusting each other more. We've seen action that has been coordinated between regulators and governments and central banks all over the world. And that really does seem to have had a major effect in helping with the credit markets.
I had promised people that I was going to have a TED spread party when it dropped below one. Is it time to have a party?
Well, certainly the rates have been consistently dropping since almost in a straight line since the market got over the shock of Lehman's and AIG in September last year. So, you know, it might be time to pop the corks.
Hang on, David, just one second. Why is the TED spread so low when we're still seeing news about trouble at Bank of America and Citi and so on?
I asked, Simon Johnson, our friend at MIT, about that. And he thinks basically what's going on is that everybody understands that the government has the bank's backs if there's trouble. And so that's why they have confidence, and that's why the banks are also willing to lend, at least for these short periods of time. The TED spread is for loans that are 3 months in length, so it's not super long-term lending.
Folks, if you want to keep track of the TED spread yourself, it's in a box on our blog at npr.org/money. You know, Planet Money lives in a lot of different places. One of the places we live is on Flickr, where we have a Flickr group. And someone posted a photo there the other day that really got our attention. It started with Caitlin jumping up and saying, "You got to see this thing." It's a picture taken through a windshield of a sign on the side of the road.
It's kind of amazing. It's handwritten, and it's the sort of sign you would see for a yard sale. It's white plastic. It's in a metal stand. And it says, "I need a job, college grad with professional experience, family man." And it's got a phone number on it.
So we went ahead and we called, and it turns out that this particular sign was made by a guy named Scott Sommerfleck. He lives in Fort Myers, Florida. He works in computers and tech support, most recently in the IT department at a hospital. Scott says he's been looking for work now. He was laid off for about 8 months. And the signs, they're just kind of his latest strategy.
Well, I got the idea is, one problem on my mind is, you know, we're losing our health insurance. And, you know, I was driving around town and there was somebody who put signs up around town. Are you looking for health insurance? Call this 800 number and you know, we'll sign you up.
So he thought, great idea, I'm going to put up signs looking for a job.
Yeah, Scott said that he'd seen stories about people in New York wearing these sandwich boards and standing out on the sidewalk passing out resumes. But to him, this is a way to be in 10 places at once.
So he put out 10 signs. Where are the signs?
Well, they're in places where there's a stop sign or a traffic signal on sort of a somewhat high traffic road, so people have to slow down and they'll have a little time to look at them. the lettering on the signs, they're not that big. You can't just put it anywhere.
So how's it going?
Scott says he's gotten a few calls, not always the kind he was hoping for.
It was hard at first because, you know, I thought I'd get, you know, calls in the middle of the night from crazy people. And they did get a few, but some people call and just say, well, you know, we understand what you're going through and we're going to pray for you. And some people call about, you know, they don't really have a steady job, but, you know, I can come and help them with this computer, you know, for an hour or two.
And David, Scott says he did get a couple of interviews out of the signs so far, but for now, he's like a lot of people. He's still looking.
That is so hard.
I think it really is. Scott, you can tell he sees how bad the job market is for him and for so many other people. I mean, for him, he says if he can just maybe go the extra mile with something like one of these signs, then maybe that will be the magic trick that makes the difference.
It's kind of discouraging because I feel like I have to resort to extreme measures to get noticed. I figure, you know, if 100 people are going to be applying for every slot that opens, you have to make yourself stand out in some way. You know, you have to distinguish yourself. Otherwise, you know, you don't get noticed. You're just one resume in a pile of resumes.
Thanks to Scott Sommerfleck of Fort Myers, Florida, for sharing that story. We'll put his picture on our blog. And folks, please keep sending those pictures. They really help us a lot. You can post them to our Flickr page, which we list on the blog. You can put them on our Facebook account, or you can email them to planetmoney@npr.org.
Hey, Laura, yeah. I brought Planet Money into the studio today.
Really?
Yeah, can you hear it?
Oh, it's a globe.
Yeah. Because, you know, we were talking about, like, is this really a global recession? Come on. I mean,
everywhere?
Luxembourg, Kazakhstan, like, here.
Somebody's got the money.
Yeah, you know, like, someone's got to be safe. There's got to be someplace we can go hide from this, right? So I talked to Ian Bremmer, who is the president of consulting company Eurasia Group. You can actually, they're right down the street from you guys, right?
Yeah, we can see them out our window.
Right. And I asked him, I said, is there some place, you know, where you could go in the world and things weren't as bad as they might be?
Yeah, sure there are. And I think that there's some of the most interesting places. One would be the Persian Gulf.
Yes, he says oil prices have gone down a lot, but the Gulf states still make a profit, unlike, say, Venezuela.
Venezuela actually runs a deficit when oil gets under $90 a barrel. In the Gulf states, you basically stick a straw in the sand, the oil comes out, it's a lot cheaper.
That is one way to survive in a downturn. Produce something the world absolutely, positively cannot do without. You can be a one-trick pony, it's just got to be a good trick. Another way to escape the global crisis would be to live somewhere totally isolated. And for sure, you could go to some remote village in the Amazon or to the mountains of China and find people who haven't heard the words subprime mortgage and haven't been affected by this whole thing. But it turns out most countries depend on other countries for something. Cambodia, for instance, sells us a lot of pajamas. Ken Rogoff, an economist at Harvard, says if he had to pick one major economy not as affected as it might be, it's India.
India is a relatively closed economy. It has much more trade restrictions, really, than any other big economy in the world. It's much harder to import anything. If you want to import a laptop there, there are all sorts of papers to fill out. Putting money into India is incredibly complicated.
So despite the fact that your tech support guy may be in Bangalore, India is somewhat insulated economically, though isolation is not a strategy Ken Rogoff recommends.
They have a lot of poor people in India. It's a country with a population more than four times the United States. And a good two-thirds of them really still live in poverty. And a lot of that has to do with cutting themselves off from the world.
This story would be a lot easier if there were some book that just listed how the economies of the world are doing. And, oh, there is one. The World Economic Outlook, published by the International Monetary Fund. The report lists one country with a bright forecast. Liberia. GDP is predicted to jump from 8.6% growth to 14.3% in 2009. But they're a special case. Liberia is coming out of civil war. Charles Collins is deputy director in the IMF's research department. And even though the IMF produced that report, don't believe the numbers, he says. Most are being revised downward.
We are expecting most industrial countries to contract quite severely in 2009. In fact, the largest synchronized downturn really in the post-war period. We cannot find a parallel since the Second World War.
I mean, I suppose on the one hand, that's sort of to be expected. On the other hand, is trade really such a big deal that we all get dragged down together?
Well, this is a massive crisis, and it's a crisis with many different tentacles, many different channels of transmission. Many countries are being affected by the drop in demand for their manufactured exports, but other countries are being affected by the drop in commodity prices. Other countries are being affected by the drop in availability of financing. So if we don't get you one way, we'll get you another way.
Trade ties us together. So do the financial markets. People and institutions in one country investing in another, lending to each other. Well, they used to lend. I asked Ken Rogoff at Harvard if he thought the crisis would have spread so far, so fast a decade ago. And he laughed, because we had a crisis 80 years ago that also went global very quickly.
The Great Depression is very similar in that the United States was the epicenter. We had this incredible boom, the Roaring Twenties, and we handled it very badly, and it collapsed, and we really took down everybody else with us.
So, Laura, the thing about the Great Depression, you know, the world was definitely tied together by trade. It's been that way for a long, long time. But it was interesting, he told me, you know, the markets were also tied together.
Like in credit default swaps now?
No. They had this other problem, which is that the countries, they had all, it was the gold standard. They'd all pegged their different currencies to the same thing, to gold.
So all boats sank at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, there was basically, it's sort of complicated, but yeah, they were, you know, because the United States basically sucked up the gold in the world, and that caused problems for everybody else.
All right, more to come on that. Thank you, David. I got to tell you, you really pulled the wagon today, and I very much appreciate it. Folks, we'll be back podcasting on Monday. Keep those photos coming for the blog, npr.org/money. I'm Laura Conaway.
And I'm David Kestenbaum. Thanks for listening.